Welcome back, everyone, to Podchat Live. Here we are on the 19th of March, 2024, and we are recording episode 118. Hi, Craig. I mean, these weeks are just
Hey.
flying by, aren't
Oh, I know. I thought we did it just the other day, but yeah, it was a week ago.
Oh dear. We've got quite a bit to get through. I think I feel like I'm saying that at the start of every episode. I should stop saying that, but it does feel like a week where we've got a fair bit to get through, a bit of news, a few articles. But let's kick off as tradition dictates with a fact from you, Craig, about a running shoe.
Well, yeah, I didn't actually know what running shoe fact I could mention today. So I went to ChatGPT and it says, tell me an unusual running shoe fact. And they gave me a whole lot of stuff that wasn't really of any interest, but they gave me one thing from 2017. And I'm surprised that I missed it at the time. But some of you may be familiar with the Reebok Floatride running shoe. Back in 2017, Reebok developed that into a boot for use on the International Space Station. So it's got the float ride technology in it, and then obviously a high top that straps up. So literally, the Reebok float ride running shoe extension is used by astronauts on the International Space Station
That is a cool
back from
fact.
back in 2017.
You know who I think might like that, and that's Tom DeCanto. And I say that because I know he's a fan of the Float Ride because he's the person a few years back who recommended the Float Ride to me, and I bought a pair and I enjoyed it immensely. Weirdly, although Tom and I are nowhere close to being the same sort of runner, I am, clearly not anywhere in the same stratosphere as him. We have a really, really similar taste in shoes. We seem to like the same shoes and dislike the same shoes. So, I suspect he may be interested in that fact.
I might.
We've got.
I'll tag him. I'll tag him on it and see if he knew about it.
He may well have already known, absolutely. More news. As we always said, we try and. If podiatry or podiatrists are in the news, we thought we said we'd mention it. Unfortunately, every time we seem to do so, it seems to have been in the sort of guise of podiatrists being a little bit naughty. And we have another one here. This was posted by Fox 5 Atlanta. It's been posted about on many news stations, but we caught it on Fox 5 about 6 hours ago, and it's just been announced. It's obviously been going on for a while that a podiatrist in Tennessee, Memphis, Tennessee, has been convicted in a what they refer to as a foot bath fraud scheme. So this is the Advanced Foot and Ankle Care of Memphis Clinic, and apparently the gentleman there, the podiatrist there, regularly prescribed antibiotics and antifungals to be mixed into a tub of water for his patients to use as foot soaks. Now the really fun thing I think here is that these sort of drug cocktails, as they referred to them, weren't just powders, creams. Some of them were capsules. Some of them weren't even water soluble. It was basically like a George's Marvelous Medicine of stuff. I could just imagine a bowl of water with capsules in there that haven't even dissolved. And ultimately, the medications were chosen based on their anticipated reimbursement rather than medical necessity. And they're saying between October 2018 and September 2021, they were reimbursed over $3 million. And this gentleman has been convicted of 5 counts of healthcare fraud, faces a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison for each count. So that is a potential 50 years, and he is 59 years old. So I think we would call that a life sentence in most terms. And apparently the sentencing is due on June the 20th. So what a lovely, fun, cheery story to start with.
I can recall so many similar to this over the years. Every year, someone pops up and you just roll your eyes. What on earth were they thinking? Especially that one that they would do it when it's not medically necessary or indicated, and two, the fact that they actually thought they might be able to get away with it.
Yeah, I think the dollar signs or the pound signs are some people's worst nemesis, aren't they? Right,
Oh, yeah.
on with the research. First article. This is from a journal that we don't frequent very often, and I don't think we're going to be mentioning it that often in the future. But it is the Homeopathy Journal. And I'm going to keep an open mind as I read this. Try not to let my own biases or opinions bleed into my speech, but it was published last week, and it is from a single researcher from India. Full caveat, I can't get the full text here, so I'm just reading the abstract. I've tried to get the full text, I can't access it. It is called Facilitating Healing in Diabetic Foot Ulcers Using Homeopathy in a Multidisciplinary Integrative Approach, Two Evidence-Based Case Reports. So we have two patients with diabetic foot ulcerations, and they've had diabetes for 12 years, and their foot ulcers are identified as Wagner grade 2. So just in case anyone who's listening isn't totally familiar with the Wagner grades, Wagner grade 1 is a sort of superficial ulcer, partial full thickness. Wagner grade 2 is a deep ulcer, which extends to ligament, tendon, joint capsule, bone, or fascia, but no osteomyelitis, no abscess. And then Wagner grade 3 is deep abscess or osteomyelitis or joint sepsis. And Wagner grade 4 is partial foot gangrene. So we're talking about two patients with diabetes. They've had diabetes for 12 years and they have deep ulcers which extend to ligament, tendon, joint capsule, bone, or fascia. Both of them were on oral hypoglycemic agents for their managing their blood sugar. So they continued their diabetic medication. They were being given advice on regular wound dressing. So I guess they were having what we would call normal care. And the diabetic foot ulcers showed signs of healing within 12 weeks. And the conclusion of this is that this indicates the likelihood of a causal relationship between the clinical outcome and homeopathic intervention. For some reason, the homeopathic medicines used, and I can't probably pronounce these correctly, but I'll try, Arsenicum album and Lachesis. Apparently, respectively, they were found useful by each patient. Craig, we've probably got fairly similar opinions on homeopathy in general. Firstly, let's before we start kind of letting our own biases of homeopathy assume, this is just a poor bit of science, right?
Oh, I'm so much biting my tongue at the moment.
No, don't. I think I speak for all the listeners when I say let your tongue off the leash and go for it.
I think, I mean, the reason I sent this one through to you as a one we could possibly talk about was the title, Two Evidence-Based Case Reports. There's no freaking evidence anywhere.
Oh, I thought we were going to get a swear out of you then.
I just thought, well, typical of that, say, genre of particular journals that publish this is they'll put things like that in the title. So there was no evidence to indicate the use of them in the first place. And then the second part of the title was a multidisciplinary integrative approach. Now, that obviously means that a lot of other things were done to treat these ulcers. I hope offloading was done. They're using wound dressings. Hopefully there's better glycemic control of these people. So how on earth they conclude that the homeopathy had anything to do with the healing is beyond me.
I agree.
It's
I
sort
mean,
of
small sample size of two here, but interesting that they chose to they could have used one as a control group, and
Oh, exactly.
at least run a comparison.
I have no problems with case control. Case reports. I find them interesting, but it's the strength of evidence. And I did. There is another one we could possibly talk next week about a case report of Kohler's disease of three people, which I find really interesting and really opens up some. So there's nothing wrong with that nature of. But it was just it was more the evidence, the word evidence in the title of the article that sort of got me the most.
And some
And as
pretty
far as I'm
bold
concerned,
conclusions.
there's not one good randomized controlled trial that stands up to scrutiny that shows homeopathy works. I mean, it is that simple. Every systematic review, every meta-analysis has concluded the same thing. So again, it was more the use of the words that concerned me the most.
Yeah,
And the
I
fact that
think.
they included the likelihood of a causal relationship based on two case reports in which a lot of other treatments were given is, beyond me. But yeah.
A bit of a stretch, it's fair to say. We will link to it. It is not open access. I can't get the full text. If anyone can, please do fire it over. Although I actually don't bother. I'm probably not going to read it. Right, next paper. This was published 7th of March. and it was published, this is one of these open access, published in the British Medical Journal, Open Sport and Exercise Medicine. So BMJ, Open Sport and Exercise Medicine. And it is called Relative Energy Deficiency in Dance, RED-D, a consensus method approach to RED-S in dance. So this one really caught my eye. It's not so much a big bit of research rather than it is a sort of, I guess it's sort of like a consensus statement, a Delphi study, isn't it? But it's from a big group of people from universities and from ballet companies, a sort of collaboration. And it caught my eye because I'll be absolutely honest, I'd never heard of the term RED-D, completely new to me. And I think it may be new to many. RED-S, of course, a well-known term. I think historically, we probably all were taught, those of us that are old enough, were taught it as in its old name, which was the female athlete triad. Obviously, that it's changed name for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because it's a complex multi-system disorder. It's not just three things. But secondly, it doesn't just affect females. It affects males as well. And therefore, the terminology was changed to RED-S, Relative Energy Deficiency in Sport. Quite rightly, when you take something like dance, professional dance in particular, an environment where physical activity can often, you know, greatly exceed 30 hours a week, and where it's been said there's a culture that might instill a value that being thin or of low body weight is required, this puts dancers at very high as a very high risk group for RED-S. So much so that the sort of term RED-D, relative energy deficiency in dance, has been sort of specifically developed. So the purpose of this study was to try and provide dance specific guidance on this sort of complex condition. So we'll link to it in its open access, but just to quickly summarize, it was sort of a Delphi panel method where they had a steering group, and then they had an expert panel, and then they had focus groups, and they also involved PPI, which is patient public involvement. So a really nice bit of work where they've got all the major stakeholders to have their say. And basically, they were trying to develop a RED-S diagnosis pathway. Oh, sorry, RED-D. I've done it already. RED-D diagnosis pathway, management plan, and risk stratification, and also a return to dance pathway. So we've now got some dance-specific pathways that could be practical tools for any of us who see dancers, you know, guiding, supporting them, and managing RED-D. So anyone that works in dance, I'm sure that if you work in dance, you're probably already aware of this. I'm a bit late to the game. But I'd not heard of it before, and it makes total sense to me, Craig. How about you?
Oh, yeah. No, look, I this is an extraordinary piece of work, and I'm Nick Allen's the first author. I'm assuming he's the one that's done all the legwork. You know, a Delphi of this size is an extraordinary undertaking and an awesome piece of work. But the thing that struck me the most about this was the strength of the consensus in that there was a huge amount of agreement between all the experts. As this is, you know, when it comes to the you know, we have the evidence on what the risk factors are. We have some evidence from RCTs on the treatments. There are some treatments that perhaps haven't got as much strength. But when it comes to the strength of the consensus amongst the experts about what the risk factors are and what the management treatment is, there was extraordinary consensus. So that gives and very little sort of, say, dissension amongst the experts. You know, it's quite clear on what should be done to manage these people. And this consensus makes that very, very clear, which I was, you know, probably most impressed on that. Some of the stuff I was a little surprised at, but I'll go along with it. One being the vitamin D, but that's, you know.
Just spoon feed the listeners a bit as to just to kind of get them excited and hopefully steer them on to want to read the paper. But what specifically surprised you?
Oh no, the recommendation for vitamin D. Because there is an extraordinary amount of evidence that low vitamin D levels are associated with RED-S and RED-D and a number of other conditions, but the strength of the evidence from controlled studies in intervening with vitamin D is quite weak. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but they recommended quite strongly that vitamin D supplementation should be used, despite the weakness of the evidence. That's why I'm a bit surprised it was there. In fact, the agreement to include vitamin D supplementation was 100%. So they're all saying do it. I'm just given the strength of the evidence, and not only in this and a lot of other conditions, that it is so strongly recommended. Now, at the end of the day, you're not going to do any harm by doing it, so I presume that's why it's highly recommended.
Yeah, playing it safe almost.
Yeah.
But I think this is of interest. I mean, I hope, you know, it was certainly the case for many, many years that I think people would see, particularly podiatrists, would see injured athletes, dancers, you know, whether they be professional or amateur, come into their clinic with lower limb, you know, foot, ankle pain, and immediately have the biomechanic, look through the biomechanical lens, have the blinkers on. And I hope, sitting here in 2024, we've got we're in a place where the majority of us are thinking much more broadly. We're very much considering low energy availability, and we're asking those screening questions of all of our athletes. But in dancers, it feels like it's almost a necessity.
Yeah, I think the difference with dance versus running and other sports is there are body image issues in dance that complicate it. But look, it's really strange. I can remember my first, probably second year after I graduated. In those first couple of years, I remember seeing a number of navicular stress fractures in late teenage female runners and scratching my head. And I can remember attending a sports medicine conference. I can't even remember the year, but it would have been within a couple of years of me graduating, where this came up. And no one had any clue what was going on. Why were these females getting more stress fractures? And I think the best suggestion at the time was it was biomechanics and the wider pelvis and the way they run. Like none of these back then. Yeah. So when you look where we've come from with our understanding of this, it's come so far. Like I think it's awesome.
Yeah, agree. Right, final paper, and we're back on running shoes again. So apologies to anyone that's not into them, but this was published the 14th of March, so just a couple of days ago, and it was published in Footwear Science, which is a great journal if you haven't come across it yet. Title of this one: Injury and Performance Related Running Biomechanics in Advanced Footwear Technology Compared to Minimalist Footwear. And the leader or author on this one is from Oregon State University in the US, collaborated with a couple of people from California. So immediately we've got a study where you look at the title and you think, oh, look, it's comparing minimalist footwear with some other footwear. And that feels very 2012, 2013. It feels a bit dated. But just to let you know what they mean by advanced footwear technology in the title, that is the term. And through the paper, they refer to it as that. They even abbreviate it to AFT. That's the term they're referring to describe where a shoe incorporates a maximal midsole cushioning design with an embedded carbon fiber plate. So I think it's probably what over the recent years we have been referring to as the super shoes or the ergogenic shoes, or you know, they've got so many different names now. I'm not sure I like advanced footwear technology. I've always quite liked ergogenic shoes, but anyway, that's what they're referring to. So essentially, this is a study that compared a ergogenic slash super shoe, a carbon plated shoe, with a minimalist shoe with regards to injury and performance related running biomechanics. Now they open up by saying there's not much research on the effect of these super shoes on common biomechanical risk factors for injury. And they also say that not much work has been done on more recent iterations of the shoes. Most were done on the early prototypes. If you think about like all of the work that was done on the kind of the 4% work that Nike did, it was done on a shoe that doesn't even exist anymore. So this one took a more recent, it says that, and then it tells us the shoe it used, which is the Nike Vaporfly Next Percent. Now, we're on the Next Percent 3 now. I mean, so they're already using a shoe that's two models old, two versions old. But anyway, they used the Nike Vaporfly Next Percent. They compared it to a minimally cushioned road shoe, which is also no longer available, the New Balance Minimus. That was discontinued a while ago as well. So I'm not sure how up to date this paper is being. But other thing to mention, 12 subjects, participants, 12 runners, all of whom ran at their own marathon pace in both of these shoes. But what you need to know is these were collegiate level athletes. So their marathon pace was 5:48 minute miles on average. To convert for those that use kilometers, that's 3:38 minute per kilometer pace, equivalent to a 2 hour 32 minute marathon time. So I'm not sure, well, it certainly doesn't extrapolate to myself and Craig. I'm not sure how many of you out there it extrapolates to. But they then looked at a load of measures in these kind of elite level runners between a carbon plated shoe, which is old and no longer exists, and a minimalist shoe, which is old and no longer exists. And it was interesting that they referred to the eversion excursion at the rear foot as being significantly greater in the next percent, and they referred to there being reduced ankle dorsiflexion in the next percent. They were the only two things that were significantly different between the shoes. Nothing else was reached statistical significance. They went on to say, of course, that eversion excursion was something they referred to as an injury-related metric. And I don't know how we feel about that. So it was interesting that they sort of opened up with their aims, their objectives, like all research does, saying that, we haven't looked at recent shoes and we haven't looked at sort of things like biomechanical risk factors for injury. And then they looked at shoes that weren't particularly recent. And I don't know that we are really happy that they looked at what we call risk factors for injury either. And all we really found was that people move differently in these two wildly different shoes. I mean, what did you take from this, Craig?
Look, well, I'm just on the on how recent the shoes are. I'm just trying to do a bit of. They submitted this for publication on the 14th of September last year, which means the study was probably done early 2023 or late 2022. Given the timelines to actually do research, write it up, submit it for publication, have it reviewed. So, I'm not sure we're going to get. If a study was done again today on the most recent version of the Vaporfly, it'd probably take 18 months to get it into press as well.
Yeah, very true.
But again, it's that, how accepting are we that eversion excursion or in inverted commas overpronation is a risk factor for injury? And if we look at the systematic evidence of that, it's either doesn't exist or is quite flimsy. But I did find it interesting. They did pick one study to cite that eversion excursion has been associated with navicular stress fractures. So you can cherry pick a couple of individual studies to show there is a link, or you could look at the systematic reviews of all of them. So again, we just have to take it with caution. But again, I find it interesting that there's more and more of these studies on the biomechanics. Most of the biomechanical studies have looked at running economy. This is one that looked at what they claim to be, biomechanics associated with injury. And I don't, again, I don't think there's any consensus there that that is the issue. So I, yeah.
Yeah, not sure how much we can take from that, and it certainly only applies to 2.5 hour marathoners at that pace. So we all know that when you see someone running in an X percent at sub four, sub or nearly 3.5 minute kilometer pace, that looks pretty different to 6 minute kilometer pace when you're thinking about contact times and flight times and things. So yes, anyway, we will link to all of these papers as we always do. Please do reach out to us if you've got any comments, if you want us to ask us anything, or you want us to talk, or if you've seen a paper that we haven't mentioned, we don't catch them all, of course. We're on social media, as I say each week. Please do give us a follow, give us a share, share the podcast, like, rate, subscribe, all the other things that I'm supposed to say at this sign off stage of the podcast. Our email is getinvolved@podchatlive.com. And we look forward to doing it all again in 7 days' time. Craig, it's a pleasure as always.
No worries. Great. Thanks. And we'll see you next week.